Now, then we'll go on to our final paper by Horace Meyer. Can you hear me?
Okay. My personal and professional relationship with Van Vleck started in 1957 with a letter from him, and as I hope to show in my talk, this relation made a dominant impact on my personal, professional life, and I'm extremely indebted to him for his generosity and kindness to my wife and to me. Our relationship lasted to the end of his life, and then the friendship continued with our communication and visits to his wife, Abigail. My talk will therefore be concerned with our scientific and personal relationship, with memories, correspondence, and some amusing stories. So let me start with the necessary scientific background. In his early papers published in 1928 in the Physical Review on the dielectric constant and magnetic susceptibility, you heard about that from Dave Huber, Van Vleck calculated the magnetic susceptibility on the basis of the Hund rule of molecular quantization, and in particular, he dealt with the susceptibilities of gases, free molecules of oxygen, O2, and nitric oxide. Now, at that time, no spectroscopic evidence existed on the proper term assignment for oxygen. And Van Vleck decided that the simplest was to assume that in the normal state of oxygen, there were three closely spaced 3S levels, and he used his formula for the Curie's law and found good agreement with recent susceptibility measurements at room temperature and at lower temperatures above the boiling point. They confirmed his assignment of the spectroscopic terms. He remarked in his paper that, in fact, oxygen is the only known paramagnetic molecule with an even number of electrons. Various paramagnetism is the usual rule for molecules with an odd number of electrons. In the liquid and solid state, the measured susceptibility of oxygen diluted with nitrogen to diminish the oxygen-oxygen interactions was found to obey Curie's law. But then what happens at 60 degrees or so, below 60, when KBT, KB being the Boltzmann constant, is comparable to the 3S structure splitting? Well, they were 20 years later, there were predictions by Cook and Werner Wolf at Oxford for the oxygen-oxygen gas. The susceptibility tends to a constant value, and I think that we learned something from Dave Huber about the susceptibility becoming constant as T is equal to zero. So more about this later. Well, a more interesting challenging situation Van Vleck found was that of nitric oxide, which, as he wrote, provided the most striking confirmation of his entire theory, both because the nitric oxide band spectrum furnishes unambiguous term assignments, and also because the doublet width is of such magnitude to test quantitatively the finer point of the theory, he wrote. Spectroscopic measurements had determined the splitting between the lowest state and the upper one by to be 170 degrees K. And Van Vleck developed a systematic theory of the magnetic susceptibility of nitric oxide as a function of temperature, as you can see here. It is a free gas. In his paper, he gave full details of this calculation, but by the time he had written his famous book, The Theory of Electric and Magnetic Susceptibilities, further measurements of the susceptibility of nitric oxide had been made. I show them here. And so, which he can compare to his theory. This is in his book in a different way of presentation. And he was very pleased. In his book, he did not repeat the detailed derivation made in his 1928 paper. This was no doubt prompted by an encounter with Wolfgang Pauli. He relates in a 1968 paper on travels in Switzerland. When I informed Pauli that I was writing a volume on electric and magnetic susceptibilities, he remarked, "I don't republish my papers as a book." And perhaps this remark made me extra careful that my volume had more in it than my early papers in the Physical Review. Well, condensation of both oxygen and nitric oxide at temperatures of the order of 100 degrees, as you can see here, just limited comparison of the experiment with the predictions. However, a new promising approach was given by the study of molecules trapped in clathrate. And so these are beta-quinone clathrate organic compounds that have almost spherical cavities here in which at most one molecule can be trapped. And the word clathrate derives from the Greek meaning enclosure. These clathrates are grown from a saturated quinone solution in N-propyl alcohol under pressure of the gas to be trapped. And depending on the pressure, which spans the range between 30 and 150 atmospheres, between about 30% and 80% of the cavities can be filled. If the gas pressure is below 30 atmospheres, then the beta-quinone form is unstable and you cannot trap the gases anymore. So here's a sketch of the clathrate crystal that shows the cavities, slightly ellipsoidal, and one can expect that at low enough temperature, the trapped molecule will be oscillating like this and then also rattling up and down in the cage. And the X-ray data of Palin and Powell show that all the cavities are equivalent, but owing to the distortions by neighboring filled molecules, they are not quite, and this is essentially shown by electron spin resonance and nuclear quadrupole resonance. And the clathrate compounds, they are produced in various forms, such as gas hydrates, and they are used for temperature, room temperature storage of gas under high pressures. When Mary O'Brien, a fellow at Radcliffe College at Oxford, was on a year sabbatical at Harvard to work with Van Vleck, she told him about the magnetic susceptibilities measurements between 1 and 20 degrees K carried out at the Clarendon Lab at Oxford by Cook, Werner Wolf, and myself, and they greatly interested him, and this tied well with his interest in the oxygen molecule. To interpret the results, they first noted that the calculated susceptibility of the rigidly frozen oxygen molecule subjected to an infinite hindrance potential did not agree well with the experiments that extended down to 1 degree K, as you can see here. And however, they expected that a smaller potential that permits hindered rotation might work. So they developed a theory that took into account a hindered rotation of the oxygen molecule in the cages. However, from the analysis of the oxygen of the Oxford experiments above 1 degree that you can see here, there was no distinction between their theory and those in the theory for the free gas. So Mary O'Brien informed Van Vleck that I was going to extend the measurements below 1 degree K, which would clearly decide between the two theories, free rotation or hindered rotation. Then, out of the blue, suddenly came a letter. And so he said, well, I'm delighted to learn that you are making measurements, and do them quickly, please. And if your measurements confirm our theory, this, of course, makes a better paper. And then, of course, if you're able to run nitric oxide down to temperatures or half a degree, this would be wonderful, but it's the oxygen, blah, blah. So anyway, this set up our interaction. And the results then are shown in the next slide. You can imagine that Van Vleck was extremely pleased, because you see, this is the curve that he and Van Vleck and Mary O'Brien worked out, that was the result of a fit with a certain hindrance potential there's a little contact problem, but at any rate, it corresponds to a hindered rotation frequency of about 5 times 10 to the 11 second minus 1. So you can see that this clearly shows that the hindered potential developed by Van Vleck and O'Brien fits the results very well, while the free gas, of course, does not agree. Stimulated by Van Vleck, who was very interested in the susceptibility of nitric oxide, I then set out to make measurements over the temperature range between 1 degree and 300 with nitric oxide in the clathrates. And I completed those before the summer of 1957, to the delight of Van Vleck. However, I was unable to get the use of the cryostat for temperatures below 1 degree that Van Vleck had wished. And so, although I had an appointment from two institutions in the US, which I was considering, a sudden unexpected offer from Van Vleck for junior position at Harvard made me decide to go to Harvard. And as you can see, that Van Vleck again was instrumental. You can see that this is an airmail letter. You can see this is the old-fashioned way that we use to have airmail letters. And so he very much helped in getting me a visa to go to this country. And so when my mother and I finally arrived in New York by boat, and we took the train to Boston, Van Vleck was at the train station to welcome us and to bring us to a hotel. He was most hospitable to us and helped my family and me getting settled in Cambridge after my mother returned to Europe. He also took me to a football game to explain the rules of American football. During the 2 years of our stay in the Cambridge area, he and his wife, Abigail, were most hospitable to us, taking us for drives, inviting us for meals to their large and elegant home. Van Vleck's marriage was a very happy one. His students and myself were in awe of him. He was the great theorist. He was infallible, but always courteous and indulgent to them, and also to me, an experimenter. However, to Abigail, he was not the towering eminence he was for us, and she appeared to be running the show at home. One excursion in particular with the Van Vlecks remains in our memory. He was driving, Abigail was sitting on the passenger seat, my wife and I sitting on the back seats. After some driving, Van Vleck took a wrong turn at the bifurcation. Abigail turned to him and said sharply, "Van, you are so stupid," which came to us as a great shock, but which then we found rather amusing later on. Knowing that I would move to North Carolina eventually, Van Vleck delighted in introducing me to the South by reciting, "Nothing can be finer to be in Carolina in the morning," which he repeated several times. And also he recited the words of the Chattanooga Choo Choo. Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga Choo Choo? Track 29, boy, you give me a shine, etc. Developing a theory to the susceptibility results of nitric oxide proved to be much more difficult than for oxygen, and it took Van Vleck several years of work off and on until he was ready to publish a long and very complicated paper with the comparison between the experiments and the predictions. We published our respective papers in the same issue of the journal Chemical Physics of Solids in 61 after I had already left for Duke. Here again, there was his hand in talking to the chairman at the physics at Duke, who was his friend. And so here in the slide, I show comparison between the experimental data and the theory. So here, there is again the laser. This is the free gas here, and here are the experimental points. And now he's making addition to the for the effect of the crystalline field. This is something that David Huber referred the influence that Van Vleck's theory using the crystalline fields. And he added the contribution from the inert rotation, assuming the trigonal field. He took the potential energy value of 45 degrees for the hindered rotation of nitric oxide. This is the intermediate between the nitrogen and the oxygen. This was a very educated guess, and these were obtained from the susceptibility, and for the nitrogen, this was nuclear quadrupole resonance by Scott and myself in the class rates. but his theory fit the results quite well, except there was a problem, is that there was a 1 over T term that did not agree with the experiment and that made him very unhappy. He was, in fact, devoted a long discussion in his paper to explain why the 1 over T term was not observed. There were questions of relaxation times and our susceptibility, susceptibility measurements had been at a frequency that did not permit to measure the 1 over T term, et cetera, et cetera. So he suggested to me spin resonance experiments at low temperature and gave me order of magnitudes for the condition of the observations. My research associate, Earl Hunt, and I got our radio frequency spectrometer all tuned up, and I prepared a sample, and we ran the magnet up and down, but unfortunately, we were unsuccessful in detecting the signal over the estimated range. And of course, Van Vleck was extremely disappointed. However, he was greatly cheered by two other class rate experiments which confirmed quantitatively his theory. The first was the electron spin resonance with Siphoner and Walt Kleiner. And these, in fact, showed very clearly the hindered potential, and they gave a value of 34 degrees, which compared very well with the analysis by Van Vleck of the susceptibility measurement. And so I mentioned a kind of fine structure. This was the interaction of the molecules with the neighboring cages. This is something that I referred to briefly before, the molecules of neighboring cages influence each other. So in the nitric oxide, the other series of experiments were in the far infrared where I collaborated with Paul Richards and Joe Burgill at the Bell Labs. And there, the resonances the absorption confirmed the hindrance potential fall of 47 degrees in Van Vleck's estimate, as you remember, for the fit of the susceptibility for was 45. So he was extremely pleased. Well, after this experiment, correspondence with Van Vleck shifted to rare earth iron garnets. And there, these where calorimetry measurements had been carried out at Harvard by Brooks Harris and myself, and subsequently in my group at Duke. And the garnets were a hot topic of investigation in several laboratories in the US and abroad. And these garnets, in particular the europium iron garnet, were a long-term interest of Van Vleck and remained so until very late in his 70s. And the reason is, of course, the following, is that the europium iron is, which is trivalent, this is in is J is equal to zero, the ground state. And the first excited triplet states, J is equal to one, lie at an energy that is about 450 degrees above. And so there is a second order Zeeman effect that is important because of the proximity of the first excited J is equal to one state. And so this leads to a magnetic moment of the ground state and a susceptibility tending to a constant value. This is already what Dave Huber mentioned. So these ferrimagnetic compounds are magnetically ordered into two subletters with spin, iron spins, the so-called tetrahedral and octahedral sites denoted by D and A with antiparallel alignment. So there are three halves as many D as A sites, and the spins are antiparallel. Limited time does not permit a description of the personal interaction I had with Van Vleck on this topic and of the Duke results that were of interest to him. However, I mentioned that these compounds are very important in industrial use because of their magnetic optic properties, for instance, the so-called Faraday rotation, namely the ability to rotate the polarization of light passing through the garnet. The garnets are key elements in several technical applications, such as Faraday rotators, optical isolators, holographic storage, and magnetic sensors. Van Vleck was more interested, in fact, in the dynamic properties problem, was more interested in the dynamical problem on how europium iron achieves thermodynamic equilibrium in rapidly varying field than he was in static properties. He was extremely well informed on the experimental and theoretical advances on this topic, as correspondence with him showed. But Van Vleck was not happy with the progress in the understanding of the dynamics. In the summary of 1968 paper that I mentioned here, Van Vleck wrote, "In conclusion, we can simply say that it is frustrating that we do not yet have adequately, that we do not yet adequately understand the relaxation processes involved in the magnetic resonance experiments, and and that there are more unsolved theoretical problems connected with the magnetic behavior of the trivalent europium than there were 35 years ago. However, progress was made all the same. In the 70s, he published his last papers on the dynamics of magnetic interactions in europium iron garnet with Mario Folio and Robert Sukurka. These publications appeared in the Proceedings of the Royal Society because in 1973, Van Vleck had been elected foreign members of the Royal Society, and that preceded by a few years his Nobel Prize. And he was, of course, invited to publish in these the proceedings. After his four last page handwritten letter to me in 69, showing keen interest in our relaxation measurements in europium iron garnet, there are no further records of letters from him. But he delighted in sending me vintage postcards from various places, several from Switzerland, Here is one from the Duke Medical School. And so this refers still to the sublattice magnetization in europium iron garnet and entry. There are a number of then further. Here is a picture, one of the many postcards he sent from Switzerland. He refers in a very sweet way. He refers to my wife, Rosemary. In fact, it's Ruth Mary on the card. I think it's very funny. And so he was a very touching person. A visit to Harvard in 1975 led me to take this picture of him before the ivy-covered walls of Harvard building. His expression hints the kind and very generous person he was. As Chun Lin wrote to me, Van Vleck gave his last lecture, Fine Structure of Molecular Spectra in Medicine and Interstellar Space, at his alma mater, the University of Wisconsin, in the spring of 1979, lively and witty as ever. A reception was held in his honor in the Van Vleck Hall here. That was named after his father. On October 27, 1980, he took a peaceful nap and never woke up. He made his final journey home when Abigail brought him back to Madison for the burial alongside the graves of his beloved parents. This is courtesy of Chun Lin. During my visit in the last 70s, Van Vleck liked to reminisce about his travels and about the international timetables that he had memorized. And then we discussed Japanese prints. He gave me a hiroshige of his vast collection. He sent me a reprint of his article published in Helvetica Physica Acta that contained remembrance of his travels. He autographed his reprint with Vive la Suisse, of course, to a Swiss. And so, as the fond memory of him continues to live in many of us, I would like to conclude my talk with a heartfelt Vive Van Vleck. Thank you.
Well, certainly a very moving account. Any questions? Or anyone in the audience care to tell some Van Vleck stories?
I'm giving a talk, as it turns out, about him in a couple of days. It's just coincidental that I put in an abstract to talk about him. And Gloria is actually going to be the chair of that next class. You who might hear my talk on Thursday, forgive me for repeating it, but I know a lot of you will not be there. I was a college and graduate student at Harvard from 1960 to 1969. Nicol Bloembergen was my thesis advisor. As a freshman in 1960, I had decided to concentrate in physics, so the physics department assigned an advisor, and that was John Van Vleck. And I won't tell the whole story, but I'll say that I was in awe of all of the theoreticians at Harvard, and what I learned at Harvard was that the math people were up there, and then the theoretical physicists were maybe a little bit below, and then the experimental physicists were sort of down here, and the engineers, well, they were down at No Caltech down Mass Avenue. It's a very elitist place. By that point, theory was king. Now that's my perception. No Caltech, oh my God. So I thought of Van as one of the great Harvard theoreticians, and I took group theory from him in my first year of grad school, but I want to come to the big moment, which is what my talk culminates about, and this will be what I'll be talking about in a couple of days. I finished my PhD in May of 1969, and I was interviewed by Nico and several other faculty members. I did all the talking, so they didn't ask any questions. I'm a talker. And then they said, you go outside and stand in the hall. And then they invited me back in and said, congratulations, Dr. Nguyen. So, you know, I was feeling pretty good. I've now passed my PhD. I also had a job waiting. Everything's pretty nice. So I left the room feeling very good. And it just so happens that right outside, I'm in the hall of Pierce Hall, and John Van Vleck is walking by there. And I said, hi. He says, hi, how are you? And I said, guess what? I'm Dr. Nguyen. And he said, congratulations. What did you do for your thesis? Now, I am not a shy person, but I did consider myself not a mathematician and not a theoretical physicist. I was an experimental physicist. So I got a little bit shy, and I kind of shuffled my feet and looked down at the ground. And I said, well, I built a laser. And he says, you built a laser? That is wonderful. How did you do it? So, okay. So I described how I built the laser. And then I went on a little more. And then he says, it is so terrific to be able to build something and make it work. We theoreticians would be nowhere without people who could build things and make things work. So I'm starting to feel better. No longer third class. Maybe I'm second and a half class. And then he said, J.J. Thomson was a hopeless experimentalist. He couldn't get anything to work. He would never have discovered the electron if he didn't have experimental colleagues who did all the work. And then basically he's telling me, you are really terrific because you could build something and make it work. Well, by that point I was floating, and I sort of floated out of the building and back down to my apartment, and my wife said, what happened? I said, guess what? And I told her that story. That is a very big, momentous day in my life, that I was no longer a third-class citizen. John Van Vleck had elevated me up there to be as good as the theoreticians. And that is something that has stayed with me my entire life. So that's my little story.
Any further discussion? If not, we'll call this session adjourned.
Well, thank you.